Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. Today, my guest is Master Corporal Ray Schilke of the Cape Coral Police Department in Florida. Ray, welcome to PD Stories.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to become a police officer, Ray?
Depends which police career you're asking about. Originally, I was in the Army as a military policeman, and both of them are kind of funny stories. I wouldn't say I was inspired to become a cop in either job. When I went to the Army, the recruiter asked what would it take to get me to join, and I told him, guarantee Germany and I'll do it, because when you're 18, you don't think there's jobs. You just think it's a soldier. That's, you're in the Army. That's your job.
Right.
And so I went and signed up. I tested high enough for any job. I'm like, oh, well, I should do intelligence. They said, okay, but training's a year. I'm like, disregard. give me a minute. I'll call my dad. So I called my dad. I'm like, Dad, they want to know what job I should do. And aren't they all the same? He's like, nah, just, I was an MP. It was kind of cool. Why don't you just do that? And that's how I decided. And then I ended up being in a military police. And then I did that for 5 years. And then when I got out, I moved over here to the Fort Myers area. We're from the east coast of Florida, but my dad retired, and so my family moved over here. I had no reason to go back to the east coast, and I was bartending at Bennigan's, which was the place to be at the time.
I'm sure it was.
But I'm not the right kind of guy for making cash every night. I'm just not responsible enough. Like, I'm the type of guy, like, I'm going to the beach and forgot my sunglasses, and instead of turning around, I'll just buy new ones on the way there. So eventually, like, after about a year, I'm like, I need a real job. So I went to the fire academy and took the test. And they're like, all right, everything looks good. It starts in 8 months. I was like, what do you mean 8 months? Let's get this thing going. And they're like, well, we don't know what to tell you. So I was all jacked up on caffeine, driving to work the next day. And it dawned on me that I was already a certified cop outside of the state of Florida. So I was like, well, I could just get hired as a cop now instead of waiting. Literally, that's how I made my decision. My dad retired at 44 from the East Coast as a cop, and he's always had it pretty well. I mean, he always worked a few jobs and everything, but him retiring young and everything was something that, you know, interested me. But really, I just didn't want to wait that long to go to the other academy if I could get hired right away as a cop. So I walked in the door. I said, hey, guys, I'd like to help. And he said, all right, we'll take you.
And that was it, huh?
Here I am, 12 years later, yeah.
Now, when you were an MP in the service, where did you go abroad?
I went to 16 different countries, but I spent the first 3 years in Germany, which was a great time. I worked regular patrol duty. It was like a slow area. It was UCOM headquarters with all officers and stuff, so I wouldn't say we exactly got a lot of action. My company did deploy a few times, different platoons, but the closest I came to deploying, we were on the bus ready to go to Iraq at the beginning of the war. They shipped all of our weapons out. All the wives are holding the banners, saying goodbye. We're sitting on a bus. We're sitting there for like 3 hours. They're all still holding their banners like, do we leave or what do we do? And it turns out Turkey backed out at the last minute, and that's where we were going to go in through, and they canceled our orders at the 11th hour. So from there, once I was done in Germany, I was stationed in San Antonio as a bodyguard for a general, and he was in charge of U.S. Army South, which is pretty much anybody who's in the Army in South or Central America. He oversees that. Mm-hmm. So every month we're in a different country, and there was a six-man team. We're plainclothes. I was an agent, technically, so nobody knew my rank. And I was in a different country every month, but it was okay because I didn't have a family yet, so I was lucky. I got to travel quite a bit.
You were single.
And,
You were single in South America.
The single part too much, but it was fun. it was incredible. I'm not gonna lie. I was in a different country every month, getting per diem $75 a day or something like that. Because generals don't eat MREs and sleep in tents. They stay in nice hotels and eat steak. So, and we have to blend in like we're part of the crew. So we ate pretty good down there, and we had a good time. And San Antonio, I tell you, if you haven't been there, one of the best places in, like, Texas should be its own country. It was incredible.
Now, when you were with the military traveling around like that, did anything interesting happen at all?
Well, most of them was hijinks with me and my friends in the barracks. but as far as, like, police work and stuff, the most we ever did was, like, busted some colonel's kid up in somebody's attic smoking weed. Had a helicopter in Panama. The rear engine failed, so we kind of came down harder. Like, we were, like, swaying left and right, and I hadn't been on a Black Hawk before. And I'm like, I don't know if this is normal, but it's not fun. And I look forward, and the guy in front of me is like a major, and he's got an Air Force tab or airborne tab, air assault, all this stuff, and you could tell he's been through it. And he's got this look on his face like,
we're gonna die.
This is it. Yeah, and I was like, okay, I guess I should be scared. And we ended up coming down kind of hard, and then but we landed. We didn't crash or anything. It was just like not optimal. And then we had to fly like three more times that day. They brought a different bird out. But we're just going out to the jungle to check on like a med ready. They go out there and give, like, doctors go down and give kids new teeth and stuff. And so it wasn't like a hot zone or anything. It was just, I don't like helicopters anymore.
I don't either. I had one experience on a Coast Guard cutter doing a 9-day drug interdiction cruise. And before we left Roosevelt Roads Naval Base in Puerto Rico, I was looking at the helicopter up on the deck of the ship, and I'm talking to one of the Coast Guard guys, and I said, so we're going to be going up in that helicopter on some night runs, right? And he said, yeah, but it'll break down before we get back to port.
Oh,
I'm like, what do you mean it'll break down? He said, well, that's a French helicopter, but the U.S. government mandates that all the 50% of the parts in any aircraft used by the military has to have American parts in it. So they buy a perfectly good French helicopter and then jerry-rig it with 50% American parts.
Really?
And, yes. And on night number 7, I'm on the ship. My cameraman, Tony Zimbardo, is up flying on the helicopter as they're looking for go-fast drug boats out there at night. And I hear, mayday, 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 tail rotor malfunction. And they had to make an emergency landing in Guadeloupe. I did not see my cameraman for the last 2 days of the cruise. My sound man and I had to use the one little camera we had to complete the shoot. And this was during my America's Most Wanted day. So I've had, that's my one experience with a helicopter. And thank God I wasn't on it.
Ugh, I didn't even get to hear Mayday. I just got to look at the guy's face and I saw Mayday. and they were National Guard guys too. They weren't even like real Army. So I'm like, oh my God, these weekend warriors are flying us around. Like, we're so screwed. But and then when we went to Bogota, like, so our job, like however many days in country the boss was going to be there, we would leave that many days ahead of time, mm-hmm. basically Secret Service, and we would mirror whatever our days were going to be. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to eat at this restaurant. We need to go there and figure out where's he going to sit, where are we going to sit, where can we dip out if we need to.
Advance work, all the advance work.
Yeah, and it was cool stuff. The training for that was incredible. Mm-hmm. We had a briefcase with a MP5 in it.
Nice.
Like, you're shooting out of a brief, you know, it was like spy stuff. It was really cool. The driving training was cool. But actually, like a week after we went there, or like a few days after we left, they found a car in front of the restaurant where we ate packed with explosives. So, but it's Bogota. It probably had nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. But when we found that, I was like, let's just skip that place for a little bit. Maybe just go to Panama or something instead.
What year was this?
I was there 2004 and 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city, though. Bogota, people don't know it, but that it's the architecture and everything is really nice, as well as the citizens.
Yeah.
it was a beautiful place, but I guess the crime is something else.
Well, let's talk about your family. Your brother and father were also police officers?
Yeah. So my dad was a cop growing up. We were never rich or anything. He always had two jobs. We always had it pretty good. Then I became a cop. My brother had been a military police soldier, but he was put out for being a little overweight. He went through a divorce and stuff, gained a little weight, and they're like, all right, you got to go. And then I got out, and he had been out for about 3 years, and he was working at Lowe's, I think. And he was doing carpentry. And the Army, like the old cadence says, got a letter in the mail, go to war, go to jail. Well, he got that letter. They're like, hey, you're coming back, report to Fort Dix in a month, you're going to Iraq. He's like, man, if you guys thought I was heavy before, you're not going to like this. Like, we don't care. We need bodies. You're going.
Mm-hmm.
So he went for a year to Iraq, but it gave him a clean slate because he went over there as an MP. He got out on a regular discharge, fresh off deployment, bunch of money in a bank. So when he came back, he had a whole new look on everything. He got out of carpentry and he became a cop. So all three of us ended up working at my agency because my dad retired. He was only 44 and my mom got divorced for a little while.
For a little while?
Yeah, they're back together. Christmas okay. is less awkward.
I've never heard anyone say my mom and dad got divorced for a little while. I've never heard that before.
That's like saying, I got a little cancer. You know, no, they got divorced for a little bit.
Okay.
But he was a little bummed out. So I brought him to the Oktoberfest with my shift. I was on night shift, a rookie at the time. Night shift's where all the rookies should be. But just kidding, that's an inside joke. But it was like 12 of us having a great time. And he came with us. And the thing is, he had me at 20. Well, he didn't. My mom did, but he was there. And my brother was only 16 months after me. And then my sister was only 5 years old. So they started young. Mm-hmm. So when he was a young cop, he never got to do that stuff like the Oktoberfest or go to the bars with his guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And now he's like, well, it's just me. Like, this is fun. I missed this. I didn't get to do this. So he's like, screw it. At the time, he was like 46. He's like, I'm going back to work. So he came to work for my agency, actually. And so him and I are working for Cape Coral. My brother gets back from Iraq. He comes to work for Cape Coral. Mm-hmm. And ironically enough, my wife works at City Hall. You'd think that we, you know, ran the city or something like that. But it was really cool. And my dad actually ended up on motorcycles a year after I got on motorcycles. So we got to ride around together all day. It was like Chips, only both of us were John. Neither of us were like sexy or anything. We're just like sunburned German guys riding around together, pulling people over, confusing people with the same exact name. And I'm the third and he's junior.
Wow. So. And he's 46 when he starts doing motorcycle patrol?
But he had done it before. Okay. He was a cop back in the 80s. He was a motorcycle cop. Back then, they had him on night shift on a motorcycle. Like, he was getting in chases. He ended up in cactuses and stuff, like chasing people through sugar sand. Like, he went to the hospital a few times. He wrecked his bike. He was a little more reckless than me, or tough. He would just say tougher, but I say reckless. So when he came here, he already had his motor certificate and everything. I mean, obviously times had changed, but he showed up and like was better than us at everything because he had already done it before. But it was really cool to get to work with him every day. But the problem is for my brother is that since my dad and I were already traffic, we all have the same last name. Like if he were to get detective or traffic or something like that, it would look really bad. Like why are all these guys getting these good spots? So my brother gave it about 5 years in our agency, and then he packed his bags and went over to the sheriff's office. And so I don't get to see him anymore, and my dad retired, and so it's just me now with the magnifying glass on me because my brother and my dad were so much better than I am.
Oh, I'm sure you're pretty good at your job, Ray. I'm sure you're so
I'm
modest,
I'm just saying
man.
That just in case they listen to this. But ironically, though, my brother went to the county and he's in traffic a year later. So I guess he got what he wanted.
Yeah. You know? Now, what was your training like? Because you had been an MP, you didn't have to go through all of the police academy training, right?
That's funny. So when it came to hiring me, they told me they would hire me if I put myself through the crossover course, since I was technically an out-of-state police officer already. I had to pay and put myself through this 3-week course. Paid, put myself through that, showed up here, and they put me into what they call pre-deployment, where they teach you the stuff that we do in my agency. Because they teach you the academy stuff, then you show up here, and they're like, all right, remember all that stuff you just learned for 6 months? Forget it. We're going to show you our standards. So I showed up with a brand new group out of the academy and just kind of jumped on board with them. So it was easy. I mean, after the Army and, you know, I wrestled a little in high school. I wasn't good or anything, but, like, wrestling practice was harder than anything I did in the Army, and the Army was harder than anything I've ever did here, I guess physically. So mini academy or pre-deployment was cool. It was easy. And then we hit the road. The problem is the course that I did just got me ready for the state test. You know, it didn't teach me stuff. Like, I was telling somebody else I was on the road about a year on nights, and we pull up to a house, and dispatch says, just so you know, on the subject you're about to meet, universal precautions on him. I'm thinking, oh, okay, I'll be careful. Like, we use precaution on everybody. I don't, what's the point of you telling me that?
You hadn't heard that term, universal precautions?
I never heard that term in my life. I'd been on the road for a year.
I have not.
Okay, so universal precautions means they've got a bloodborne pathogen, like an HIV or a hep C or something. It basically means do everything you can to not fight with this person.
Okay.
Because then you're going to have to get the cocktail. But I didn't know. I'm like, universal precautions. And so somebody else shows up to back me up, and I'm like, hey, why does dispatch keep saying universal precautions? Like, is this guy a black belt or something? Like, what do we need to know? And he's like, you joking? I'm like, no, what is this? Like, he's got HIV, man. I'm like, oh, that would have been good to know like a year ago. So that whole crossover course thing, like, I kind of would have just rather did the academy. They put my brother through the academy. Worked out well because, you know, he learned that word right away, I'm sure. And got his GI Bill while he was there, you know. But not me. I just kind of jumped on board because I just wanted to get hired. So maybe I told them that patrolling in Germany was a little more serious than it was. I don't know how my interview went, but I wanted to get hired. But in hindsight, maybe I should have just been like, hey, I'm a good guy. Put me through the academy. But I've stayed out of trouble, though. So
well, that's good.
I guess I must have had good enough training. But I've done other training since I've been here. But as far as just training to be a cop, that's kind of how that went for me.
And you also did a course on Florida law too, right?
Yeah. So you have to learn there's just little differences here and there. Like if you're in like Pennsylvania and you get caught shoplifting or something, they give you a summons. You know, down here we give you a notice to appear. Up in, for instance, in New York, if you punch somebody, I think they call it assault, right? You get charged with assault. Down here, it's called battery. Assault is just me making a fist and saying, I'm going to punch you, and you're within an arm's reach, and you're in fear. That's assault down here.
Really?
Whereas up there.
You don't have to actually hit somebody to be charged with assault in Florida?
No. They call it battery. It's the same thing. It's just different words, you know? So well, let me ask you this. So if you punch somebody in New York, you get assault, right?
Right.
If you threaten to punch somebody and you scare them and they're like, I was in fear. Yeah, he was gonna hit me. What did they charge you with?
You can be in some jurisdictions charged with terroristic threats, or there are different nomenclatures for it.
I just wonder what their step down would be from assault. You know,
typically,
I mean, ours, we have battery and then assault.
Yeah, typically. So. If you didn't physically touch someone or even spit on them, you're probably not going to be charged with assault in most places in America. But Florida is a unique place. That's why there's...
Well, assault is not as common, but like an aggravated assault. You point a gun at somebody and
yes.
you threaten them,
mm-hmm.
or you pull a knife on somebody and it's on camera and they were legit scared, even though they didn't end up using it.
That's different.
They should
yes. be charged
with something,
right? A weapon does
so there's
change.
Your assault.
A weapon changes the dynamic of the potential charge.
Yes. So that one's a lot more common than regular assault because we have to pretty much be there. I can't just show up and you say, hey, he threw a karate kick toward me and said the next one was going to hit me in the face. If I didn't see it happen, that's going to be hard to make a charge on. But then there's other things like in California, you flick a cigarette butt out the window and they'll chase you for 2 hours with the news cameras following you. You know what I mean? Down here, we're not allowed to chase you unless you're a violent felon or people are in danger, you know. So there's little laws here and there in Florida that are different. I like to think we've got it more squared away than everybody else. But when I hear everybody else talk, they always say that all the crazy stuff happens in Florida. So maybe I'm the one who's wrong. Ironically, nobody's from Florida. They're all from everywhere else.
Right. There are a lot of websites devoted to Florida man, Florida woman, and then whatever they did. Coming after Florida man, Florida woman as the headline. So you've seen this.
Yeah, I mean, Florida man charged with, and it's always something outrageous.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like people of Walmart, people of Florida.
Yep.
But they're all from somewhere else.
You know, on Live PD, we're in Florida in Pasco County, and we see some interesting Floridians in Pasco County. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I guess we got a lot going for us down here. Yet everyone keeps moving here.
And you got sun and palm trees.
Yep.
Now, you worked when you were working as a motorcycle officer, what was the training like? Because I understand it's pretty, you have to go through some, unique training because of the nature of just the bike itself, how much the bike weighs. If it goes down, you have to be able to pick it back up.
Yeah, so motorcycle school is 2 weeks long, and they say physically it's one of the hardest schools a police officer will ever do, just because you're on the clutch all day long squeezing it. It's like you're squeezing one of those forearm things from the 80s, you know, like but all day for 2 weeks. And you drop your bike all day long because you're on a closed course, and you're supposed to do all this stuff on a tight cone course and everything. And we're working with, at the time we were on Harley Davidsons, they're like 800 and something pounds. Mm. Not to mention how hot they get. I mean, they burn up, you know, 300 degrees or something.
And it's hot as hell in Florida where you're doing this too, right? I mean, you're doing this outside in Florida where it's hot as hell.
Yes, it's incredibly hot. You're picking this bike up all week long. By the end of it, I couldn't turn my doorknob. Like, I had nothing, no grip strength left. Luckily for me, I was pretty coordinated, so riding wasn't an issue. Some of the other guys didn't make it. A lot of guys break their ankles in this course. Or blow their knees out, because naturally, if your bike's falling, you don't think, your foot just goes down to try to save you. Well, you ain't stopping 800 pounds, you know. So I would say half of the people who go through the school drop a bike on their ankle and break it.
Wow.
I can name probably three in my agency that have been through the school, didn't make it through. So it was a tough school. But I just I was lucky. I had not really been on a motorcycle much before, so I didn't have any bad habits. Like, dirt bike guys put their feet down when they come around a corner. That's just natural. They're the worst guys to try to learn police motorcycle because of those bad habits. And if you're not breaking your ankle, you're getting screamed at when you do it. So they get that out of you. But I don't know. I was good at it. I did it for 7 years. My daughter was born at the two-week school. The Thursday night of week one, my wife went into labor. We had our kids, so they gave me Friday off. They said, just make sure you show up on Monday. So since she was my first kid, I said, you know what? I ought to take 2 days off for this. This is a big deal. So we had our daughter, brought her home probably Sunday morning, and then I came back to school on Monday, finished out the week. And three of us passed the school, but there were two positions. And I had this new baby at home, and they're like, do you want the job or do you want to – you know, do maternity leave or whatever, you know. I was like, I guess I'll see you on Monday. So, you know, I didn't bother taking any time off for my first kid. And luckily, my wife is really cool, because when you're riding around on an 800-pound piece of metal in traffic all day with people that potentially want to kill you, you should probably get a good night's sleep. So I told my wife, you know, I work Monday through Thursday, so on those nights, you take the overnights with the baby. On the weekends, I'll take the overnights, and she was cool about it. So, like, I got pretty lucky in that regard. It was fun. But I did it for 7 years to the day. And I remember that because I left the unit on my daughter's birthday and came back to patrol. So they like to rotate so that you don't stay there forever and hog that spot. They want other people to get a chance to do these cool jobs, you know.
You know, I've never asked anybody this question on PD Stories, but you bring up an interesting point about working out parental duties with your wife. And people don't realize how difficult being married to a police officer can be, whether it's a man who's a police officer or a woman who's a police officer, and their husband, significant other, has to deal with their schedule. Talk about that a little bit.
I don't know about up by you, but down here it's very, very common. A very common equation is cop teacher or cop nurse. Mm-hmm. A lot of our officers are married to teachers or nurses, and it works out really well because the time off. So we work 12-hour shifts, so I only work 14 days a month. When I was in traffic, I worked Monday through Thursday. My wife's not a teacher or a nurse or anything, but she works for City Hall, so she's Monday through Friday. So when I was in traffic, we were together every weekend, and I didn't work shift work. I was on days. But for the most part, like when you're on 12s, if you're on nights, and that's why a lot of our guys are married to nurses, because they meet them on the night shift in the ER and stuff like that. And the nurses work shift work also, you know. But then one gets put on another shift. They don't see each other anymore. I think the divorce rate's probably high in every job, but you don't hear about what accountants are doing at home or what, you know, clerks are doing at home, but you hear about cops and firemen and military. You know, a lot of my friends have been divorced and stuff just because the shift work gets to them or whatever the case may be. But where we are, we've got it really well to where once you go somewhere, you're there for a few years, so you can make it work with the family. And it's really not too bad. In regards to the kids stuff, my kids only ever know of me being a cop. So it's like we've got a lot of other people that work here who already had kids and got into police work late and stuff. And we got a guy on shift, Mike Jackson, we call him he got into it at like 40 years old.
You call him what?
You know, his kid was our because his name's Mike Jackson. I think I'm literally the only one that does that.
Okay.
We also call him Latoya. But anyway, his kid's like 8, you know, and he's a brand new cop.
Uh-huh.
So it's a heck of an adjustment for them. You know, he'll go to work and you know, he got into a fight a few months ago with a father and a son, ironically, and they took a taser from the other officer, and I think somebody ended up in a pool, you know what I mean? And like when you're 40, and he was like, he ran the
Back up a minute. You're kind of blowing through an interesting story here. Tell us a little bit more about this fight.
I wasn't there for the fight. I only heard about
it. Tell me what you heard, because I'm intrigued by this.
One of the officers got his taser taken from him.
Uh-huh.
But I think it ended up in a pool or something like that. But it was a melee. Like these father and son just attacked these two officers, and they're both newer officers. And the bad guys went to jail, and the good guys went home. That's about as much as I know. I don't know if there were like fists and stuff, or it was more like a tussle, like a wrestling match. But everyone wears cameras now, so I'm sure there's footage somewhere. But
and he was in this.
He was in this fight. Yeah. He had the dad and the other guy had the son. And where I was going with that is like he's not a big built guy. He's a regular guy. You know, he ran a Dodge dealership for a while, the parts department, and he's getting into this at 40. So now all of a sudden you're 40 years old, probably haven't been in a fist fight since high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to go to domestics. You got to, you know, walk into other people's houses and tell them to sit down and close their mouth until you're done investigating, until you've done, you know, decided that a crime hasn't been committed. And that's an awkward thing to do. I started doing it at 19 and, you know, in the Army, and we worked domestics and stuff. So it wasn't a huge deal, but try that at 35 or 40. This is an awkward job to get into. And that being said, it's, if you haven't been doing it forever, it's even more awkward for the wife and kids because all they know is what they've seen on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like my kids were born and I was already on motors. I had been through the night shift before. I was in traffic, you know, so they don't know anything different. So they really don't think anything about me going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally they'll see me on the news or something doing something, you know, local charity type stuff. And my one kid, he was 4. He's like, "Daddy, you're always on TV." I've literally been on like 3 times. It's a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But like, they just think it's normal, you know, but that's not the case for every family here, you know. I guess it was the same for me. My dad was an MP when I was born. He went straight to the police department, and it's the only thing I've ever known. So I don't think my wife gets nervous when I go to work or anything like that. She just, I don't know, we all get complacent, the families as well. And so do we as officers. And then something really bad will happen. And lately in Florida, I think we've been wearing our mourning badges for about a month straight. We just took them off.
Yeah.
It's been nuts around here lately. It kind of reminds you that it could be Mayberry, but you could still get shot at a red light just for being in a cop car.
That's true. You know? That's true. Now, when you were a motorcycle officer, what was one of the most bizarre things that happened to you, a most memorable thing?
There's been a lot of weird stories, a lot of crazy stuff. We had a guy driving around killing people one day, just blasting people. He had watched that movie They Live, and I don't know if you know, with Rowdy Piper, he puts the glasses on and some people are aliens and some aren't.
Yeah.
He was tripping on something and he was just driving around shooting people. Well, like 3 hours before he did that, I was at Circle K gonna go get a soda, but I was typing my report. I was parked right there. He walks right up to my passenger window. Luckily I saw him coming. So I always have my hand on my gun when somebody walks up to the window because you never know. Mm-hmm. And he just comes up. He goes, "Hey, I'm going to go inside real quick. I got to drop off a computer is that okay? I'm like, what? Yeah, go. Get out of here. He's like, well, my kid's in the car. He's parked right next to me. I'm like, yeah, yeah, go. Do your thing, man. It's fine. He was a weird-looking guy, so I remember thinking, like, who had a kid with you? But that's irrelevant. He didn't shoot me or anything, but, like, 3 hours later, we get a call that some guy's driving around shooting people. I think he shot 4 people that day or something. And when they finally got the tag and I ran the tag and his picture came up, I mean, you want to talk about chills. Like, this guy literally walked up to my window.
Wow.
Could have – he wasn't on whatever he was on yet. So that one's a little off, but the weirdest thing that ever happened – so when you're on the motorcycles, you don't just ride around all day trolling, I guess. Consider it like fishing. You can troll where you're burning up gas all day hoping that something grabs your bait, or you can find a good fishing hole and sit there and drop your bait in the water. Well, motorcycle cops, everyone always sees us parked under trees. They think we're just being lazy or hiding from the drivers or – no, it's hot. We want shade. That's it. We just want shade. I just want to eat my lunch. And I listen to my radar, and you hear a high tone. You look up. You get your stop. We step out, wave you down, flag you over, and stop you. But one day I was sitting there sweating, and these two women walk up to me. They're like, hey, we need your help. I'm like, all right, well, what do you got? And he said, our friend texted us last night at like midnight, and it said, help, don't call back. I'm like, so we called her back, but she didn't answer. I'm like, okay, did you not read the text? Help, don't call back. You should have just went to her house. So I was like, you know, I pretty much told him that, you know. Like, well, why didn't you just go and check on her? And they're like, well, here's the thing. She's got an abusive boyfriend. His name's Thunder, and he's 7 feet tall.
What?
And he's got nunchucks. Yes, that's what I said. I'm like, what? They're like, he's 7 feet tall. His name's Thunder. Our friend went over there a few weeks ago to check on her, and he came out and he beat our friend up with nunchucks.
Oh my God.
So in my mind, I'm like, first off, where are the cameras? Are y'all pranking me? Like, who names their kid Thunder? Either way, I thought they were blowing smoke up my rear end or something, because he's 7 feet tall. I'd have seen him by now. This is a small town. Everybody knows everybody. His name's Thunder. He's got metal nunchucks. They're blue, they told me. I'm like, that's some flea market stuff right there. Those aren't real. Legit, like, nunchucks, so he's probably not an expert. But if he's 7 feet tall, I don't want him hitting me with them.
Right.
They're like, well, we don't know what's going on. She texts help. We ain't heard from her in a couple days. Can you go check it out? I'm like, well, sure. So I call a couple other officers. I tell them the story. And they're like, mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll meet you there. But we're all just kind of thinking this is not going to be what they're saying it is, you know. And then we're also thinking, if he really is 7 feet tall, like, and he's as bad as they say, maybe we have to tackle him, or, you know, we're getting ready just in case. You know, you never want to have to, like, use weapons or something. But 7 feet, that's big. It's going to take a few dudes. So three of us go there. We're knocking on a door, and they didn't know which side of the duplex they were on. So we're knocking on both doors. No answer. It looks like nobody's home. There's no cars. We walk around the back, and there's like a GMC, a black Jimmy or something parked out back in the yard. Touch the hood. It's cold. Nobody around. We're like, weird. So we go around front. We're standing under a tree, just kind of figuring out, all right, what do we do here? And all of a sudden we hear a loud bang, like boom, like I didn't know what it was. We drew down. We pull our guns. We look back, and we look. And I had just started watching The Walking Dead, show about zombies. Uh-huh. And I swear to God, it was a zombie walking at me. It was this girl, but she had been beaten so bad, and she's walking towards us, making that noise. I'm like, holy crap, they're real. You know, I'm like, this is some stuff right here. Like, I can't believe this. And she's holding her, like, ribs, and she's dragging a foot. And both of her eyes are swollen shut. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So they're watching the window. I run up. I grab her. I pull her into the shade and sit her down. I'm like, what's going on? What's happening? And as we're doing that, the truck that was outside dips. It's just out. Goes through the field, out the back, around the block. So we call that out. We're like, all right, this car just took off. We might have called out the tag or something earlier while we were walking around the house, but we called it out. Apparently there's a big fella named Thunder in there, and that's all we knew. So I start talking to her, and she's like, he has my son. I'm like, oh boy. So she stays out there. Me and one of the other officers go in the house to clear The duplex is the weirdest place. So we walk in through the back. There's a pit bull, really friendly. We got lucky. He's like, hey, fellas, want to come in? Sure, we'll come in. So we go in, clearing the house. The living room is full of barbecue stuff, like smokers and grills and stuff like commercial grade, like big stuff. And we look in one of the bedrooms, and there's mattresses all the way up to the ceiling. I still don't know why. And we're looking, there's nobody in the kitchen, and we go into master bedroom. In the closet, it's a walk-in closet. This place was nasty, by the way. It was like squalor, I think is the word. And they were living in squalor. The closet was incredible. It had black lights and all this equipment and everything, DJ stuff. So, like, all right, well, we're looking through the room. We see some crushed up pills on the nightstand. And then there's movement under the blanket. I'm like, oh, hey, pull the blanket up. The kid slept through all of it. It was a 7-year-old boy. Slept through the noise, slept through him taking off, slept through us yelling, Cape Coral police, we're coming in, announce yourself, whatever. Kid was asleep. So it turns out he didn't get kidnapped by Thunder, which is good.
And Thunder, it turns out, is the actual DJ?
Yeah, so the reason they call him Thunder is because he was a DJ. And he was DJing for a Miami radio station, but he was doing it remotely from his closet. So if you were watching his cast or whatever, you didn't know he was just in a closet in some duplex in Cape Coral. You know, it looked like a studio. So, yeah, and it ended up working out really well because she had punctured lungs because her ribs were broken. So I don't know what would have happened, but if we didn't show up that day, I think it would have been a bad story. So she ended up all right. He went to prison. He was running through red lights, crashing into cars, everything, and he ended up hitting a car, disabling his vehicle, and he was arrested. A lot of drugs in the house. Turns out I think they had been drugging the kid so that the kid would be up at night and sleep during the day. 7 years old, he'd never been to kindergarten yet. Mm-hmm. So mom wasn't exactly salt of the earth.
Right.
But she also shouldn't have been a victim of any domestic violence. Yeah. But it was just a bad situation for this kid. He wasn't he didn't have any disabilities or anything, but talking to him was like talking to a 3-year-old. Like, because mom was too busy getting high with DJ Thunder and not paying attention to her kid. So I don't know whatever happened to the kid, because since I was in traffic, I didn't work the case. You know,
right,
detectives
right.
took over and stuff. But mommy bailed him out, and he ended up skipping bail, and then the marshals had a task for it. Like, they had a thing out for him and everything. And I don't know whatever happened to him, but he was charged with quite a few things. Mm. And through it all, the only thing he asked about during the whole interview was, is his dog okay? Mm. He didn't care about the kid. He didn't acknowledge her situation at all. It's just weird.
That is a bizarre.
He wasn't 7 feet, I tell you that much.
That's a bizarre story. I mean, that's a really bizarre
story. You asked for a weird story. I don't know if that one counts.
That's only Florida, right? I mean,
fine. Only in Florida.
That encapsulates the bizarreness of Florida crime.
There you go.
Right there. You nailed
There's
it.
Your Florida story.
Nailed it, Ray.
Boom. Firsthand, Florida story.
Firsthand.
I got some kind of award for that. I don't keep track, but I don't care, you know, about awards, but they gave me something because I saw a picture come up on my Facebook the other day, and it reminded me of that story, and that's why I remembered it. The worst part about the whole thing was the girl came back to the house a few days later because they were renting, and the landlord put them out after that. And their stuff was still in there, and she called us back, and one of the sergeant who was on scene with us that day that helped save her met her there, and she never thanked him. All she did was tell him to break the window so she can go in and get her medication. And that just, you know what, though? We don't do this job for thank yous. We don't, although here in this town in Cape Coral, I get a lot more thank yous than, you know, F yous. It's a really supportive town. But this girl did not care that we saved her a few days later. She just wanted to get back in there and get her stash. And I don't know what happened with the kid, but hopefully he's got better parents now.
I hope so. I really do.
Are you a crime junkie and want to understand more about the criminal mind and the science behind crime sleuthing? Check out A&E's Real Crime blog at aetv.com/realcrime. A&E's Real Crime blog dives deep into the backgrounds of serial killers, forensic science's role in crime scene investigating, and cold cases that need to be solved. Plus, interviews with officers and experts from your favorite A&E crime shows. If you're passionate about crime, spend some time on AETV.com/realcrime.
People have a million different excuses for why they speed. And I'm sure as a traffic patrol motorcycle, you pulled over a lot of people and you heard a lot of creative excuses for, I didn't know why I was speeding. It's because of this or that. I have to go to the bathroom. What are some of the ones that stand out?
Best reasons for speeding. I've been pulled over for speeding before, and the only thing I ever do is say, officer, I should know better. I'm a police officer.
Good answer.
And usually they're cool. But what else do you say? I never pull my badge out, say, hey, man, do the right thing or whatever, mm-hmm. like the New York cops. Hey, I'm on the job. I just say, I should know better. But I had a young girl, 18 years old. I pulled her over. She's doing like 17 over in a residential. And I was like, hey, you know, you're speeding or whatever. And she goes, officer, I wasn't speeding. I'm qualifying. And I lost it. I'm like, oh, my God. For a young girl like that to have that kind of moxie, to throw that out there, like, I just was like, you know what? You win. Go.
Oh, she said she's
qualifying. Just do it at 30.
She said she was qualifying?
I'm not speeding. I was qualifying. Yeah, like for NASCAR or something. And I hadn't heard that before, and I didn't expect it out of a younger driver, you know? And I just had to give that one back. I'm like, you know what? Good. That was funny. She might have saw it on a T-shirt or something, but either way, she used it on a motor cop who, aside from, like, Florida Highway Patrol, motor cops are, like, the next ones you don't want to get stopped by. She threw that out there, and I was like, you know what? I'm not even mad. Get out of here. but then the other one is everyone always says they're trying to rush to the bathroom. Uh-huh. So I would call their bluff and be like, all right, cool, just give me your license. Is this the correct address? All right, run home. I'll meet you there with your ticket. And you know what? It can wait. I don't have to go that bad. You call their bluff, you know, because most of the time they don't really have to go to the bathroom, although that's a decent excuse. And I had one time it was a lady, like a middle-aged lady, you know, kind of attractive, nice car, speeding, and I stopped her, and I'm like, hey, you know, blah, 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 you're speeding. And she's like, this is very embarrassing. I've got to go to the bathroom. So I did my own, okay, just give me your license. I'll meet you at the house. She's like, okay, thank you so much. She gives me a license. She's like, oh, so embarrassing. I've got Crohn's disease. I'll be right up the road. Just wait out front. And she was for real. Mm-hmm. And she started driving. Like, I had her license. She started driving. I'm like, oh, no, I can't do this. So I rolled up next to her with my lights. I got her to stop. I pulled up next to her. I said, ma'am, just get out of here. Do your thing. Because I felt bad, you know, because I got a friend with Crohn's. That's no joke.
Yeah,
but
I do,
she
too.
She was legit. Mm-hmm. Either that or she's really good at poker. But she played it up, and I ended up giving her a license back, and hopefully she didn't have an accident. So, but that's the most common that I can think of as far as why people are speeding. Qualifying was a good one. I've got a poop is a very common one. Nothing else really that I can think of that jumps out.
Have you ever been in a high speed chase?
I've been in a low speed chase where the dude was doing like 47. He punched one of our guys. He was posing as a Fish and Wildlife. He was telling people they were fishing in this area that it was $20 and they had to pay a fine or something like that. He was drunker than Cooter Brown or something like that, whatever they say. And one of our guys went out with him. He's in the car. I don't know the whole story, but he like reached out and punched our guy in the arm. It was something really weird. And then he just drove. And I think our guy was just confused by the whole thing. He said, did he just hit me in the arm? Like, what was that? So he drives, and a few of us end up on the chase. We're only allowed to have a certain amount on a chase because you don't want the whole town, and it's not like he shot our guy. But going down the main road, let us off into a thing, got out of the car, parked in the driveway, got out of the car, laid down. I think my dad's the one that detained him. And they arrested him, and I think he got a DUI. Coincidentally, I gave the guy a DUI like a year before that. He was passed out behind a wheel. Right in front of a canal, there was a big rock keeping his car from keeping going, and he was passed out, and the wheels were spinning in the sand. So I brought him out in front of my car on camera. I said, hey, man, you're not in any trouble. We just got to do some tests. Make sure you're good to go to be behind a wheel. He's like, you talking about sobriety test? I'm like, yeah. He goes, oh, no, man, I'm way too drunk for that. He turned around, and he put his hands behind his back. I'm like, I make sure my mic was on. I'm like, say it again one more time. I'm sorry, what was that? He said, I said, I'm too drunk for your tests. Just bring me into jail. Let's make this easy. I want to get back to sleep. This is the same guy who led us on this slow speed chase in the middle of the day. He gets there, parks the car, gets out of the car, immediately lays down. They cuff him up, and they ask him, they're like, why did you just do this? His answer was, it was his girlfriend's car. He wanted to get it back into her driveway so we wouldn't tow it because she was going to whip his, you know what, when he got out of jail.
We see that on live PD all the time. The cops are trying to pull somebody over.
That's the reason he ran.
And they don't stop until they get to their driveway because they don't want to be towed.
Yeah, they'd rather take the extra charge than pay the $200 impound. But we've been in some high-speed chases, too. We had a guy named Damien who was hurt real bad in a motorcycle crash, but him and I were doing step-outs one day. And some of the times when you do step-outs, people don't realize what you're doing. You know, you're waving. They think you're just telling them to slow down or something, or telling them there's something up ahead. And they'll just wave and be like, oh, hey, and then they just keep driving. And you're like, I'm trying to stop you, dummy. You know, and then you got to go after them. Well, a similar situation. They keep driving. He's like, hey, I'm going to go stop them. He goes after them. They turn a corner. They're gone. They're doing like 100 in a neighborhood. So this was them avoiding us. So he went after them. He calls it out over the radio. I had just got out of motorcycle training, and we have these berms that separate the highway from the houses. And we trained to go over those. And I was like, sweet, this is my chance to go over the berm, only it's the real deal, you know? So like I went over the berm to meet them where they were going to be. And then like by the time I got there, the car came out in the middle of an intersection. We were booking, you know, and it was fun because I was like 25 and I cared a lot more back then. I should reword that. I still care now. I was reckless back then, and I thought it would be fun to go real fast in the middle of the day, whereas now I might be like, you know, they didn't hurt anybody. I'm going to get there safely, and let's hope this works out better. Because I'm older. It's like the old bull and the young calf.
Oh, yeah, I know that story.
You know the story. I don't need to tell
from it. Colors, from the movie Colors. The one Robert Duvall told Sean
Penn.
Yeah,
and I just wanted to go fast. Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go fast. I was Ricky Bobby in it. You know, I went over the berm. Damien went after him. And then they ended up crashing into a car. They were way ahead of us. We were just trying to catch up to them. They crash on the main intersection in town on Veterans. This dude gets out of the car. He goes off on foot. Damien hops off his bike, goes after him. This other kid gets out of the car and just sits down. He's like, I don't want no trouble. And I go up, and there's cars all around the car that saw the crash, and they're looking in there, and they're like, there's a guy in there, there's a guy in there. So I walk up, I got my gun out, and I'm like, come, step out of the car. So I look in there, and he's just in there smoking crack. And I'm like, it's like
He's in the car smoking crack at that moment?
Middle of the day. Middle of the day, after the crash, he's in there smoking crack. I've got a gun pointed at him because I don't know what he's got in there, and I'm looking, and I'm like kicking a window, trying to look cool, but it's so much harder to kick a window open than you think. Mm-hmm. I was not successful. But I kicked the window. He's smoking his crack. He looks up. He sees me. He's like, oh, sets the crack down, and he gets out. And he's like, hey, sorry, man. And I cuff him up. And it was one of those things, like, once again, like I asked him, like, what were you doing? He's like, well, I knew I was going to jail. And I was letting these guys borrow my car because they were going to go sell all that crack. But when they left, I was like, sweet, I'm going to smoke this crack until the cops get here. Because it's not like you can charge me with something extra.
It sounds like Tyrone Biggums, like that Dave Chappelle character, Tyrone Biggums, the crackhead.
Hey, guys, you got any crack? Yeah, that was this guy.
I'm just smoking this crack before I go to jail, officer.
Yeah, let's get hitting his crack pipe real quick. He was loaning these dudes his car. They call it rent-a-rock or whatever. Like, you loan the dealers your car because they don't want to use the same car all the time because we know their cars. They use your car, go off into a different neighborhood, sell their stuff, and then they give you some product in exchange. Well, they dipped out, and he had a car full of crack. He's like, this is amazing. This is a jackpot. He was just getting after it until I got there. I got there, and he was perfectly polite, just really liked crack, and he went to jail, and that was that. The other guy got caught, and the other people were not hurt in the crash, which was another good thing. And then the other knucklehead he just got out of the car and sat down. He's like, I ain't running. It's pretty hot out. You guys have dogs and stuff, so I'm just gonna stay here, and y'all figure it out. But I always thought that was funny. It was like, man, it's actually kind of smart. Like, you're going to get in trouble. May as well get high before you go. I mean, I'm not into getting high, but if that's your thing, he's right. I can't charge him for smoking it before I get there. It's possession's possession, you know? But that was a good one. And that was a high-speed chase, I guess. Yeah. But I haven't been into a whole lot of other. I mean, I've gone high speed to get to like really bad crashes. And like when you're on a motorcycle, you hop up on a sidewalk and go around everybody, stuff like that. When you're running code, I mean, we don't just do that to get lunch. But, you know, a lot of times where we've been in a big hurry to help other people, more of that down here than chasing people.
Or officers who need assistance. You get a call for an officer in trouble. You everybody goes.
Yeah.
Full bore.
There's certain officers that never ask for a backup, and you know if they come over the radio and ask for one, it's real, and you go. You know, there's other ones that ask for one every chance they get, and it's usually because they're a little unsure on what to do or they don't know the statute. And they always come to me on the traffic stuff, but little do they know I just Google it all. They think I'm like this wizard. They're like, just go to Ray. He's the best with traffic statute. I just pull up the talk. I'm like, Florida statute for, you know, following too closely or whatever. And I give him the answer. I'm like, dude, you're amazing. I'm like, dude, just pull your phone out. Get with the times. But yeah, like, so being in a hurry to help another officer, I've exceeded the speed limit doing that. And then just mostly really bad crashes. We had a shooting yesterday, so obviously you go pretty quick to those. And we had a couple guys have a shootout at work. A guy was waving around a gun, pointing it at everybody. And then he pointed it at the kid who had a concealed weapons carry permit, who was aiming it at him saying, drop the gun. He pointed at that guy. He said, drop the gun. He didn't drop it, and that was that. And he shot him.
Kill him? Did he kill him?
No, I didn't kill him, but he shot him all below the waist. And he said he did that on purpose. So
that's an interesting story. You mentioned the term step out earlier. Tell our listeners what step out means in police work.
Well, that's just, I mean, I don't know who else really does them, but that's what, if I'm getting shade, sitting under a tree with my radar on, and I just step out into the road, wave my arms around, usually I'll be wearing a traffic vest, just to get your attention, I'll get you to stop, then I'll point to the side of the road and direct you over. When you're on a motorcycle, if you pull somebody over and you do the old school way, you pull behind them, I've had it happen before. I pulled this car over, he took his time finding a place, he pulled into a parking lot where he could still, you know, haul butt if he needed to. And as soon as we stop, his door flies open and he jumps out of the car. I was still reaching for the kickstand. I'm 5'3". You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, it takes a minute to park that thing. And it scared the crap out of me. I'm like, oh, I guess this is it. I'm going to get murdered now. And it was just an old guy that never got stopped before. He didn't know why I was stopping him, and he was just nervous as crap. But, like, pulling somebody over from behind them on a motorcycle is not optimal, because when you do it in a car, you can hide behind the car. They start shooting. You get a motorcycle, there's really nowhere to go. It's like an ostrich putting its head in the ground. So you may as well just do step outs, because then you're looking at them, you're aiming them over, and you got a wide open space to run one way or the other. It's not a fail-safe way to do it, but on motorcycles, you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't anyway. So we just preferred step outs just because you find a good fishing hole and stay there instead of driving around trying to find stuff. So that's kind of just what we do. I don't know if they do that stuff up north or not.
What's the most dangerous aspect of motorcycle policing?
Most dangerous part of being a motorcycle cop is the same as just being a motorcycle rider, is people don't see you. So most of the time you hear about a motorcycle cop getting hurt or killed on the job, it's usually because somebody hit them. A lot of motorcycle cops nationwide do not wear their bulletproof vests either.
Why?
So we do here in the Cape. It's too hot. You know, my dad had a heat stroke on duty, you know, because he's old school. He didn't wear sunblock. He drank Diet Dr. Pepper all day. You know, like he had a heat stroke. So a lot of motor cops just don't wear them, which is the dumbest thing in the world. Because if you look at the stats, most cops get shot on traffic stops than anything else. But more realistically, it's just crashes. People are not looking for motorcycles, which is ironic when you see those dorks with the watch for motorcycle stickers all over the back of their car. And you're like, well, how am I supposed to watch for motorcycles? I'm trying to read all your stupid stickers, you know? So, like, I get the sentiment, but, like, you don't need to put it on your car. We get it. But so like when they taught us, they said, if you're coming up on a major intersection, like wave your arms around as you're coming up on it, even if you look like a fool, or stand up on the pegs like as you're coming so everybody sees you so that you don't get hit. And I would do that. I would do like Team America World Police, where they tell him his distress sign and he like waves his arms around his head. I would do all sorts of stuff just to get people to look at me coming through the intersections. But I did 7 years to the day and I never got hit by a car. So it worked. I don't know. People just don't see motorcycles, or they get tunnel vision and they do see them, but their mind plays tricks on them and they just drive right into them. We had the left lane, you know, to turn left across an intersection was all backed up, four or five cars. And this old lady got pissed off. She's like, why aren't they going? So she goes around them to the right and makes her left turn. They were waiting on a motorcycle and she killed the guy, you know, because she didn't see him. She went around them, made her turn, turned right into him.
That's the most dangerous thing for motorcycle riders in general, is making left turns, isn't it? It's something of, I remember hearing something about motorcycles and left turns account for the most crashes. Why is that?
Here's the thing. So a lot of the intersections, you got your left arrow and you can go. But some of them, it's just a straight up green. And sometimes people just get confused. If both sides have a green, and it happens a lot in cars too, people will go ahead and just make their turn. They forget that the straight people have the right of way. Straight being they're driving straight. And so they just turn. They're like, I got the green light, I'm going to go ahead and turn. And they turn in front of people. It happens all the time. And that's just in my experience. I'm sure there's more to the science of why left turn accidents happen a lot with motorcycles. But if everybody has a green going east and west, people just don't think. And they're like, all right, here I go. And they just turn right in front of – the cars will turn right in front of a motorcycle that's coming straight through the intersection. Another thing is a lot of times motorcycles don't drive with their headlights on in the middle of the day, which they should. You should drive with your brights on.
Good point.
You know, and regulars and they get a lot of them got these nice blinking lights. They do a lot of stuff to make themselves visible, but usually it's people just see that green light and they turn and they just turn right into them.
I've actually seen it happen. Matter of fact, I saw it happen in Florida. I was with my camera crew. We were sitting at a light. The light turned green. The guy in front of us on the motorcycle pulled out, and an old lady came right through the intersection in a Crown Vic and just exploded him in front of my very eyes. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's never good. Here in Florida, you either have to wear a helmet or you have to have health insurance, one or the other. And they ask, why is that? I have my own theory. I don't know the real rules, but I think it's because if you have insurance and you're wearing your helmet, you're going to stay just alive enough for them to pay to keep you alive for 10 years as a vegetable. And it costs the insurance companies a lot of money. But if you don't have a helmet on and you have insurance, it's a one-time death benefit and they're done with you.
I see.
I have to imagine it has to do with politics, but here in the state of Florida, you either wear a helmet or you have insurance. But usually we had a lady wreck her bike today. One vehicle, it was just her. She went down on a wet road. We got there. She was out. I guess she woke up when she got to the hospital. But, I mean, think about it. You could fall off your bike and die hitting your head. You can do it at 45 miles an hour.
Sure.
You know, we're essentially 50 miles an hour or more on a motorcycle. You're a bug at that point, like when you hit stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't ride anymore.
Now, you mentioned
7 years on the motors and traffic was enough for me.
Now, you mentioned heat stroke. You said your dad got heat stroke when he was working as a motorcycle officer. In Florida, it's brutally hot most of the time. And the sun is also a real factor in policing out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And my bosses probably don't want to hear this, but the summertime, I mean, school's out, stuff like that. The snowbirds are not down. So everything kind of slows down. But our productivity actually goes down as well just because the heat's too much. You get in and out of your car, you've got a vest on. It's just miserable. And then once you start sweating with a vest on, you're not going to stop.
Your
temperature or whatever goes up and you're done. When I was on the motors, we were cool with the people at 7-Eleven, so they used to let us go in their walk-in freezer. And I'd go in there, take my vest off, and just lay down on a concrete floor. But it's ridiculous down here. Everyone used to think I was – well, now I get sunburned a lot because I don't go outside as much. But when I was on the motors, like I look back at my old Facebook pictures – I had a sunburn for 7 years in a row. Like my little German butt had no business doing that job. They used to get mad at me because I'd get in a car in the afternoon, like the captains. I'm like, dude, you're in an office. Like, stop. It's miserable out here. I'll do my work in the morning. I'll get in the car in the afternoon and type my reports. But they're like, no, we spent money on a motorcycle. We're going on a motorcycle. And it's kind of like, who wins, you know? But it's hot. And I tell all the guys, they love motorcycles. Like, I think I want to be a motorcycle cop. And I tell them, if you do it, you're not going to like bikes anymore. Because if you do something for 40 weeks or 40 hours a week, do you want to do it on a weekend also? You know, like, same like the boat cops. Like, you really want to do that? Because you're probably not going to like boating anymore. I don't know. It's just miserable. But then again, they got motorcycle officers in Minnesota freezing.
True, true.
So I don't know which one's worse.
Well, it's a unique area of law enforcement, and it comes with its own unique challenges, and it's not for everybody, but there are people that do it and people like you that excel at doing it. So
yeah, I was really good at riding. I just never had it in me to write tickets. My last year on the motors, I had over 1,000 stops, which they want to see productivity. You know, you don't have to write everybody a ticket. A lot of people are reasonable people, and they have been pulled over, and you give them a warning, and it goes a long way with them, and mm-hmm. they'll remember mm-hmm. it forever, because most people only get pulled over once or twice in their life. But yeah, my last year on the motors, I had over 1,000 stops, and I had 300 tickets. So in baseball, that's a really good average. But for motorcycle cops, batting 300, not that good. Like, nationwide, I think motor cops are like the divas of police officers. They're like the most strict ones, and most of them have flat tops or a mustache.
And state troopers.
Like, it's like there's like, and state trooper, yeah. I don't even mess with state troopers at all. But they got the haircuts, and they wear fanny packs.
Yeah, you can take a state trooper from Kentucky, drop him in Hawaii, and put him in a Hawaii state police uniform, and he will speak exactly the same way. They're all the same. I mean, and they're the lone rangers of law enforcement. They're out there by themselves. Sometimes they're miles away from the nearest backup unit, but they are a unique breed.
My best friend from the Army is a state trooper in Pennsylvania, which is totally different from Florida. Here, it's all highway patrol, from what I understand. Up there, they're regular cops, but they work out in these townships, like you just said, where there's no backup. But they're like the highest paid in the state. It's like they're legit. It's very hard to get on up there.
Don't speed through Pennsylvania.
Like up in Connecticut, if you're a state cop, like, it's a big deal up there. But down here, I don't know. Let me ask you this. Have you ever met a state trooper and you knew him before he was a state trooper? I haven't, which leads me to wonder if they're robots.
There was a guy that I worked with when I was doing, I was working for Nuclear Police Department of Energy. And one of my guys, he went to Maryland State Police, and I knew him before, and he was still the same guy. But, you know, he definitely, when he was on duty, I asked him, I said, do you speak like the way they taught you in the academy? He said, yep, everything. You never call a car, it's a vehicle. Their vernacular is very, very regimented.
And it's just like you said, doesn't matter what state you're in, they're all the same guy. It's like Stepford cops. Like, they... Yeah, it's weird.
Funny story. During my America's Most Wanted days, I worked on a case it was a homicide case that was being investigated by the state police detectives. And this detective, his name was Dick Bonesteel. I kid you not.
His name was Dick Bonesteel?
Detective Dick Bonesteel. That was his name.
His parents had a...
His name was Richard Bonesteel, and he was... And when I would call him, he would answer the phone. Bonesteel, and I would just like, I'd have to put the phone. I was just like, "Hey, Dick." I was like, "But yeah," I said, "Man, you must be the hardest detective there's ever been."
Wow,
Dick Bonesteel,
Dick
man,
Bonesteel. We had a guy named Dash Lockhart, and he just sounds like a superhero. And he was a Marine, and like, he's saved all kinds of lives. But Dick Bonesteel takes the cake,
dude. If you were a porn star, you could not have a better porn star name than Dick Bonesteel. I'm serious.
You said it, not
I
me.
Say,
but everyone's
out there in the universe now.
I can't believe that's somebody's name.
Couple of last questions. Have you ever fired your weapon in the line of duty?
No. I've not. I've we've all had to pull our weapons on high, you know, felony traffic stops, things like that. But never had to shoot anybody. I've only tasered one person, and that's because the guy I was partnered up with was not that good at talking to people. I'm only 5'3", so, like, I don't go around looking for fights, you know. I'm good at talking, I guess. I get along with everybody, and part of that is because I don't know a lot about anything. but I know a little bit about everything. So usually I will pick up on what people are into or what's going to calm a person down, and I just go and stay that route. I'm like the whisperer, like the drunk guy whisperer or the angry guy whisperer, whatever you want to call it. And it's worked out well for me so far. I mean, I've taken people down before and stuff like that. You know, when my partner's trying to cuff them and they won't go, and, you know, it is what it is. But me on my own, I haven't had to do a lot of this. I had a drunk guy yesterday, wouldn't get in a stretcher. He needed to go to the hospital, and, you know, we'd pick him up and put him in. And, you know, sometimes you have to show them, hey, I'm in charge here, and, you know, but I've never had to throw a punch. I've never had to shoot anybody. My brother got in a lot of fights when he moved over to the county. He should have stayed here. But no, just tasered one guy, and that's it. And I feel like if I was partnered up with any of the other guys on my shift that night, I probably wouldn't have had to do that. Because they were oil and water. The suspect and the guy I was partnered, they just antagonizing each other. And we're human, too. And you just can't let people get under your skin. And this particular guy was a newer cop, and he was letting everything get to him. And, you know, and that was over 10 years ago. I haven't had to use it since. I mean, on my kids and stuff, but not on suspects.
You know, a lot of people, you've touched on an interesting thing there, that not everyone that becomes a cop is really cut out to be a cop. There, it's like every profession. There's a percentage of people in every profession that probably chose the wrong profession. The difference is in law enforcement, you have authority over people. You have authority to take people's freedom. You have the authority under certain circumstances to take someone's life. And you touch on a very interesting aspect of all of this with how you deal with people. And you've seen some officers who just aren't really as good at the nuances of dealing with the public.
Right. Yes. And the way I say it like this, like we'll have a lot of, like, we changed our standards, our hiring standards a few years back. You used to be able to get hired if you had, you know, 60 hours of college or military. And if you got hired with just military, you had to get your college within 4 years. And somewhere along the way, we stopped doing that. We was bringing in college kids. That's it. And maybe it's just me, but it seems like the amount of people failing out of training has gone up quite a bit. And it's because these, I call them kids, but because these young men and women don't have real life experience. In my opinion, the best cop out there as far as all around police work, the best person to show up to a domestic or handle an angry person on a traffic stop, the best job you could have had before you did this was bartender. Mm. Because you know people. Mm-hmm. You know how to listen. You know how to relate. You know how to, you know, listen to their problems, make them seem real to you. Say, yeah, I appreciate what you're going through, but here's what's going on. To me, and luckily I was a bartender, the only thing I've ever done was bar work and police work. And I worked in a bar in high school, and I've always just dealt with people. I'm 5'3", so I've always had to have a sense of humor, so I didn't get beat up in school. You know, luckily my brother and I were very close in age, so we got a lot of practice in on each other, but I never really had to get in fights. But what I say, though, with these rookies, like when they'll fail a rookie, and I'm like, well, what'd you catch them doing, or what'd they do wrong? And they're like, they just weren't getting it. In my opinion, as long as you're not a coward or a crook, there's somewhere in police work that you can work. There's so many jobs within the department. Mm-hmm. Each personality, it's like a baseball team can't all be batting cleanup. They can't all be home run hitters. Sometimes you need a guy that hits singles now and then. You need a little guy that gets walked and gets on base. You know, a police department has detectives. They have traffic people. Traffic people are supposed to be robots that don't have a heart, and they just write you tickets. In history, historically. I mean, times have changed around here, but there's a spot for every different personality. You know, if you've got a guy who's a robot and only sees black and white, maybe don't put him in a job where he's handling domestic disturbances, but maybe on traffic he'd be good because he's just handling crashes and pulling people over, and it's the same thing over and over. If you've got a guy who's really, or a woman, or who's really, really good at talking to people and relating to people and making people like them, maybe they should be a detective because you're probably more likely to get a confession out of somebody or get somebody to open up to you if you're not treating them like crap. But like I said, I mean, just because you're an awkward person or maybe you're a little bit dumb, you know, not everybody is an alpha male like me, and not everybody has this insanely high IQ like I do. But there's a job in police work for everybody as long as you're not a coward or a crook. And that's real.
That's a brilliant summation of an answer to my question. I mean, that was really just, you covered all the bases and painted a really clear picture.
And I'm not a supervisor or anything. I have no say in this. Those are just my thoughts on it. I think that everybody that we've invested time and money into deserves a chance to show what they'll be good at. I'm not really that good at any of it. Like I said, I know a little bit about everything, but I don't know a lot about anything. But I've been here 12 years, and I don't think they're firing me yet. So I had to look up at the lieutenants real quick to make sure. But nope, not getting
fired. All right, well, good.
So maybe after this interview.
Hey, Ray, what's the number one crime problem in your community right now?
The number one crime in Cape Coral? Jaywalking? Or
drugs, heroin?
Heroin. And which leads to the more common. Okay, so that's the biggest problem, but I wouldn't call it the biggest crime in a sense of there being victims.
But a problem.
The byproduct of it is all the thievery. So this is a really safe city, like number two or three per capita in Florida. And it's number two. So it's incredibly safe. And these people move down here from Minnesota or Ohio or whatever, and they just don't lock their cars. So that's our most common crime that I know of, and I don't go to the meetings and stuff, but it's just vehicle burglaries. People are not going to run up in your house and rob you unless you have something they want. I mean, when you hear about people getting home invaded, they're probably doing something they shouldn't be. But everybody in town gets their car opened up. And it's a big problem with heroin addicts, which we have. Across the bridge in North Fort Myers, it's meth. We haven't gotten too much of that yet. But heroin and then bored teenagers. And typically when we take the crime report, we can tell who our suspect is based on what they took out of the car. You know, your addicts are going to take tools and stuff like that they can go to the pawn shop with. Teenagers are going to take your phone, your cash, a gun if they can find it. But what people don't think is they're taking your extra key that was in there or your garage door opener, and it's part of a bigger picture. So you're thinking, dang, I can't believe they got my iPhone. You're not even thinking about your garage door opener.
Because now they can get
and 4 days later,
your
you
house.
Come home, they went up in your house, they took a few things out of your house you didn't notice. Then they go back while they were in their house, they grabbed that key to that car. And then a week later, not only did your car get broken into a week ago, all because you didn't lock your door, but now your whole car is gone. And then we find it, and these are the teenagers, not the junkies typically. It's systematic. I mean, they have it planned out. And we find the car wrecked because they just joyride them for a night or two, and then they just dump them. And they usually got blunt wrappers and beers and whatever. They just go out partying in your car, and it's just a crime of opportunity. And then with the heroin thing, they just want stuff they can pawn. Most of your junkies and stuff, they'll steal your gun only to trade a dealer for drugs. They're not going to try to go to a pawn shop. A lot of the, I shouldn't say junkies, but a lot of the addicts, they're not violent people. They just, they're on that stuff. You know, they've
got to get money.
It's
they've got to get money
and
somehow.
They need money. So here where we live, and I'm sure it's everywhere, but that I would say is the biggest problem we have. It's just people not locking their cars. And a lot of people leave guns in their cars and they don't lock up. And in my opinion, you should at least some kind of a suspension, but you shouldn't be allowed to have a handgun after that. That's my opinion, not the opinion of my department. But if you leave a gun in your car and you don't lock it, you're done. You're not allowed to have a gun.
I agree.
Or some kind of a suspension or something like that. It's no different than leaving a kid in a hot car. It's irresponsible. It's dumb. And these are the same people that are arguing and say, it's my Second Amendment right. Well, then put it away. Don't leave it out there for, you know, they say, well, if you take the guns away from the good guys, then the bad guys are the only ones having them. Well, how did they get it? Because you left your car unlocked. So it's a big old cycle. You know, it all works all the way around, you know. But that's the biggest thing we have down here, that and jaywalking.
Like yeah, there was a guy, an escaped convict recently, who's on the run, and I saw a news story saying that police believed he had stolen a car that may have a gun in it because the car owner said, I think I may have left my gun in the car. And I'm like, that is so irresponsible. You don't know whether or not you left the gun in your car?
You should know where your gun is at all times.
Well, Ray, it's been fun talking to you. I want to know about your thoughts
likewise.
And advice for new officers, people who want to become officers. What's the best sage advice you can give them?
Best advice for new officers, meaning they've been through the academy and everything, and they're already here. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You got 25 years or 30, depending where you're working. I know you want to be a detective or you want to be on street crimes or you want to be a tough guy. Just take your time because I've been doing it 12 years and I'm still learning on every shift. And you're not going to learn it overnight. You just learn from the people that have been around doing it forever. And on top of that, on a more of a human level, treat everybody as if they were your neighbor or your mom. Like treat them how you would want your mom to get treated on if she got pulled over. Would you want her to call you and say, this officer was so rude to me or whatever? Or would you want her to call and say, this officer was very nice. He gave me a ticket, but he explained why I did what I did and what it was wrong. You know, treat everybody like you would want your mom or your neighbor to be treated. And if people can do that, all the anti-cop stuff will slow down. You just got to treat people the way that you would want to be treated. And that would be my advice for a new cop, is slow down, don't run down the hill, walk down it, and treat people right. You know, like, you've talked to me for an hour now. I think you would probably agree that I'm a likable guy. I'm a nice fella. Somebody might shoot me at a red light one day just because of the car I'm in.
I must say.
Just because of the badge
I must say,
I'm
Ray, I genuinely do like you. I genuinely do. You are a very likable person. Again, I hope to get
I
hope
like
to meet you one day in person, you know. I really do.
Yeah, that would be nice. I come to D.C. every year. I'll let you know next time
okay.
I come. If you live in that area, you need to go to police.
I do sometimes. I've been there
go
many
the
times, actually, yes. Mm-hmm.
You been to the wall during Memorial
I was
Week?
I was there when
you
they,
don't cry,
I was
you
there
don't
when
have a soul.
Dedicated the wall. The very yeah.
Were
oh,
you?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I've been there like 8 or 9 times, but I think this year was our last year going. But I want to go back with the family next time. But we'll have to get together.
Now, let's talk about that for a minute. Every year, May 12th to the 16th, D.C. police officers in D.C., in Washington, D.C., police from all over the world come to Washington to honor fallen officers. And it's an emotional thing. I mean, I remember being there at the dedication of the wall and the other times I've been there since. It's like going also to the Vietnam Memorial Wall. It's one of those very solemn places where you can see people, you know, touching the names of their fallen father, grandfather, son, uncle, nephew, niece, daughter that gave their lives in the line of duty. And you get a sense of just the uniqueness of police work and how serious it is. Tell me about what it's like for you when you go there.
So it's, remember when I told you earlier that we all get complacent? And we all get, we think, this job's just boring. It's an easy town. It's whatever. My dad always says police work is 99.9% boredom and 0.1% terror. And he's pretty much right. You know, some might not use the word terror, but, we run toward the bullets or whatever while other people run away. But usually you'll go a few months where nothing happens and you kind of get complacent. When we go up there and we see the survivors that just lost their husband or their wife or mom or dad, we all come back realizing that that could have been us. You know, like, you meet people from all over the country, and some of them are like us. We didn't lose an officer. We just, one of the older guys has been going for 24 years when they started it, and we started going with him, and it's just become a thing. We did have an officer get shot, but luckily he survived. But when we go on that trip, it just reminds us that we're not invincible. And you're looking at these pictures of these guys on the wall, and they look like all of us. They look like every one of us. Athletic dudes. Dudes were Marines and three tours in Iraq, and they came home and got shot their first year on the job. And you're like, really? Like, and it just, I don't know, man. It's a good trip. You make good friends. I'm going to read you a poem. This is on the wall a few years ago. I'm going to get made fun of because I have a hard time reading it. It was called Paper Daddy. It says, my daddy is a picture hanging on the wall. There's another one just like it in the police department's hall. I kiss his paper face every night before I go to sleep. Sometimes, hold on. Sometimes I pretend I can feel his whiskers tickle my cheek. I take daddy fishing when mommy isn't around. If I climb a chair, I can take my daddy down. Once I thought I saw a tear in his eye. I didn't know that paper daddies could cry. My daddy is a picture hanging on the wall. There's another one just like it on the police department's memorial wall. So instead of talking about D.C., that's the trip right there.
Yes, sir.
That's it. Like, there's letters from the reason I had a harder time this year than normal, but no, it's a really fun trip. But that, I feel like when you ask about DC, that poem just says it all. Mm-hmm. And this year I had a harder time because my kids are 6 and 9. So when I'm looking at that wall, reading a letter from a kid to their dad or in heaven or whatever, it's the same handwriting as my son.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was an officer, every single time in the locker room when I put my vest on, at that moment, every single shift I ever worked, I knew when I Velcroed that vest tight around my body that I was going out into the street and that there was a possibility that I could get wounded or killed. Because that vest always said to me, this is the difference between being an accountant and being a cop, or being a dentist and being a cop, or being a banker or being a cop. You know, and I never, ever, ever for 1 minute took it for granted. I wasn't paranoid in the streets ever. I was like you. I talked to people easily, freely, and calmly, and I really didn't have to get into a whole lot of conflicts with people. And I was in the projects in D.C. where, I mean, we had drive-by shooting with 12 people hit. I mean, you know, I was in a rough, rough place in D.C. But I got along with people. But I always understood, and I don't even think I always wondered if my family really understood that when I left, because I always worked nights too. I was, you know, I was in the projects at night. And that's in the summertime, that's a whole nother thing, you know. And I always wondered if my family really even understood the seriousness of when I walked out of the door at night, whether I'd come home in the morning, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing, that nobody gets it. You're just going to work, but until something bad happens, and then all of a sudden, oh, wait, this is real, you know? But, yeah. I mean, D.C. is, I mean, Cape Coral ain't D.C., that's for sure. But all it takes is that one crazy or that one guy who's just been pushed too far, you know? And he doesn't see Tom, the nice guy that talks to all the people on the block, or Ray, the little short dude that tells jokes. He just sees a badge, and he wants a way out, or he wants to kill someone, you know? And that's the crappy part about this job, is that sometimes there's not a personality behind the badge. They're just looking for blood. So I guess I got 9 more years and then I don't have to worry about it no more.
Well, God bless you, Ray Schilke, Master Corporal Ray Schilke, Cape Coral Police Department. It's been a pleasure having you on PD Stories. I've enjoyed our conversation. I know our audience has enjoyed it, and you know, let's talk again in the future, okay? And you be safe out there, and God bless you, man.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.